Welcome to In the Moment. Four Augustana University professors are collaborating on a multidiscipline project. It's aimed at addressing historical trauma and its impact on preterm birth in Native American women. In the Moment, host Lori Walsh sat down with Associate Professor of Physiology Jennifer Goebbels, Assistant Professor of Nursing Carla Abbott, Professor of Religion Ann Peterson, and Assistant Professor of English Beth Boyens. In this first segment, the group discusses the science behind historical trauma and how it is revealed in public health, spirituality, and literature. Jennifer Goebbels begins by explaining the inspiration behind the collaboration.
We first started thinking about this project when Ann and I went to Canada to visit David and Joanne Olson, who are Augustana alums, and they have been working on a project on preterm birth and stress in women that were affected by the fires in Fort McMurray, Canada, in May of 2016. So those fires were pretty terrible, and they had to evacuate 80,000 people from that area. And they already knew, and it's been demonstrated in the literature, that people, pregnant women that are involved in natural disasters, have a higher rates of preterm birth. And so instead of just studying those rates, they decided to go in and do something about it. And so they went in and did a riding intervention with those women. So they had three different groups. The first group wrote just about what they did that day. They brushed their teeth, you know, took a shower. The second group wrote about their feelings about the fire. So, you know, what is this the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to you? They answered that question. What are your feelings about the fire? They answered that question. And they wrote for 20 minutes a day for 4 days. And then a third group didn't write anything at all. And so they are evaluating whether or not that writing intervention helped to stop or at least decrease the rates of preterm birth among those women that were affected by the fire. And similar studies have been done with the women that were pregnant during the floods in Iowa in 2008. There's been a lot of studies on those women and the children that were born from those women, and that they have higher rates of obesity and adiposity, which is fat content.
Okay. So when was the intervention? Is it after the trauma and after preterm birth, or is it before?
So when
was the writing deployed?
The writing was 6 months after the fire. And so it was with women who were pregnant during the fire, but 6 months after the fire. So okay. It had happened and they were still recovering from it. But they were either pregnant during the fire or within 6 months of, or they got pregnant within those 6 months.
Right. I feel like we need to address why is it a big deal? Why is preterm birth an issue that is causing a problem?
Yeah. So preterm birth can lead to all kinds of adverse health outcomes for children. So, you know, they can have problems with digestion. Pretty much any body system can be affected. So they can have lots of adverse effects for their health. And not only that, but preterm birth can, if one is born preterm, then you have a greater chance of delivering a baby preterm later if you're a woman. And so it kind of is, it goes through the generations. And so when we think about stress, if a stressful event causes a woman to give birth preterm, that could affect not only her daughter, but her granddaughter as well. And so
it kind of blows my mind. and that's documented. That it can actually pass through generations, not if there's not another fire necessarily. There's not another natural disaster.
Right.
It could be a normal, everything is just as you would want it to be, and still have issues passed down.
Yes, so that's a great point, because that has been scientifically demonstrated in rats. So there's been studies where they take a grandmother rat. Well, okay, so we'll start with just a mama rat. Yeah. A mama rat who's pregnant, and they put her in a box for half an hour a day so she can't turn around, which is stressful for her. Mm-hmm. She is more likely to have pups preterm, and she's also more likely to not be as good of a mom as she would have been. So normally rats will pile up their pups in a pile to keep them warm, mm-hmm. and these moms that have been stressed will spread them out around their cage so they can't they can't stay warm. And then, so there's that. And then, so the daughters are born preterm without any further stress to the daughters. So they don't put them in a box. They do nothing right. to them. The granddaughters are also born preterm and have these adverse cardiovascular, obesity, diabetes effects. And so it's carried on through the generations. We think through epigenetic changes, which are changes not to the gene itself, but how the genes are expressed. So it changes what genes are turned on and off.
Mm-hmm. So who's with you on this trip to Canada?
Anne Peterson.
Yeah. Anne, when you're in this conversation about this research, at what point does the light bulb come on for you? Because you're a professor of religion. And so what's so engaging about this conversation for you at that stage?
So the research team up in Canada actually has on their team both Joanne Olson and at least one other person who looks at how resilience forms in these women. So how not only to leave somebody in trauma, but how to help them face their trauma and become resilient in light of it. And broadly speaking, are talking about how that involves their spirituality, which I would say is the essence of one's being, that which gives you life and center. And so the writing practices they have in their literature and work been calling spiritual practices. Now, that's a very broad term. But I think the word spiritual for me connects because what they're talking about is embodied practices. So when you heal from trauma, you can't think your way out of it. Most of the literature that's in therapeutic literature about trauma is talking about the need for embodiment so that the whole person is involved. For example, women who were generations ago traumatized by the Walk of Tears, the Cherokee Trail, mm-hmm. they've now taken these women through rewalking that trail, not to re-traumatize them, mm-hmm. but to allow their voice to be heard and to help give them their own indigenous spiritual and cultural practices. So that as they face that trauma, they're better equipped to become resilient. So my interest in this is related to the notion of resilience and hope and spiritual religious practices. And I know this voice of authorship and trauma is something that when I talked to Beth Boyens, I asked her to be a part of because she's doing work on sort of authorship and voice in trauma theory.
I'm going to get to Beth in just a minute, but first I want to go back to Carla or mm-hmm. bring Carla into the conversation for a moment. And I'm going to risk sounding a little dense right now, but it's such a big concept. And tell me more about historical trauma so that people can, you know, you can almost pass it by and go, oh, that kind of makes sense. I understand the rats. It's
sure.
How expansive is it?
So I grew up on the reservation. And my mother was Native American. My dad was German. They got together as a result of the Pick-Sloan Water Project, the Owyhee Dam Project. And being in the nursing profession, but also watching the people around me as they were unhealthy, you could tie all of that unhealthiness to historical trauma. And at first, when I was a young nurse, it didn't really make sense to me. And I would probably say I didn't even believe it. But now you can definitely see the connection. There's a lot of research done on the stress hormone, cortisol, and things like that, and all of those things, cortisol leading to prediabetes and then diabetes and things like that. So this does really make scientific sense. I've also seen the emotional side of that historical trauma and some people not being able to get over that. And sometimes the phrase, just get over it, right. is thrown a lot to Native Americans as that happened almost 200 years ago, get over it. And I think once people understand that this goes on through generation after generation, and kind of like what Jenny and Anne have been saying, it really makes sense. And so it's very disturbing to me right now because we have such a meth epidemic on the reservations. And so in a sense, that's going to be another historical trauma that's mm-hmm. going to carry through for generations. And these young people now who are getting pregnant are in very volatile relationships. All of this historical trauma is just going to be piled on top of one another.
What reservation?
I'm from Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe.
Right. So I don't want to paint too broad of a brush about what life is like in one area, you know, or the other. But people who are carrying a historical trauma then are being re-traumatized. Does it build on itself? Does it get worse and worse?
Absolutely.
So, you know, your great-grandparent was not a meth addict, but you have mm-hmm. a meth addiction problem. Mm-hmm. But this happened, you know, your great-grandparent was in a boarding school and had a traumatic experience there.
It continues on.
It continues.
And what's interesting to me is how some people overcome that somehow and are so resilient. And kind of getting back to what Anne is saying, I think it really bears looking at, where does that resilience come from? What role do things like spirituality play in that? It's very fascinating. So I think this is really an exciting collaborative project for me. I feel like for me, not living on the reservation, it's a way to give back and maybe heal some of that survivor guilt I have from not living back there. But so I'm
leave?
Really excited.
How old are you when you leave?
I was 18 and I went to college and left and haven't gone back.
Survivor guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I know a lot of my friends were just as knowledgeable as I was and were able to go to college. They just didn't have the financial resources. So for some reason, I was lucky enough to be able to go. So you do carry a little bit about survivor guilt with you. I think wherever you come from, we all think about our hometowns and where we grew up, and your heart, a little bit of your heart's always there.
Right.
For me, I feel a little bit more of an accountability to make sure that I give back. And this is one really, really satisfying way for me to help.
Beth Boyens, let's talk about your role in this. And when Ann Peterson brought you in and said you need to be involved, it's a good fit for you. Why? What were you thinking?
Well, I have a deep interest in trauma, particularly and particularly in the way that it comes out in literature. So there are a couple of ways that it does that. One is that literature that comes out of historical trauma or kind of collective trauma, the assassination of JFK, for example, or 9/11, where there's sort of this national collective trauma, but also historical trauma, whether it be Native Americans, it tends to come out of multicultural literature. So Native American or African American or Chicano literature, that kind of thing. On the one hand, the literature serves the purpose of trying to sort of restore the order, right, that's been disrupted by the trauma. That's interesting enough in itself. But more interesting to me is the idea that the literature comes as a voice out of the wound of the trauma. So rather than sort of just allowing the wound to continue to bleed, or allowing the wound to scar over as if sort of nothing happened, but that there's a voice that comes out of that wound, and the narrative, the storytelling, is that voice, and it becomes a way of healing, but also sort of crying out and calling attention to the trauma. And then the other interesting piece in terms of literature is Kirby Farrell, who's a scholar in trauma theory as it relates to literature, talks about the difference between the raw experience, which would be the trauma itself, the fires, the trail of tears, whatever it might be, the raw experience, what actually happened, and then the narrative that is told about that experience, and that there's a story that comes out of that, and that really connects to the writing that these women have done in relation to the fires in Canada. So all of this is very exciting to me, to pair the way that literature works with actual experience.
So, Beth, these are two very different things, this notion of sitting down and writing for 20 minutes a day about how you felt about the fire, how you, you know, felt about something traumatic, and a piece of literature that comes out of the Holocaust, for mm-hmm. example.
Mm-hmm.
But they're connected, too?
I think they are. I think they are in terms of how one processes these events and how one understands the wounds of the events and how one articulates what it is to have experienced trauma.
Is it healing for the writer and then for the reader as well?
I think that's the intent.
So when I look at literature, you know, by Elie Wiesel or something, mm-hmm. I'm thinking that you know, informative to me about something that I've never experienced, and so I'm learning history and I'm helping process those stories, but I don't necessarily think, because it's not my history. I mean, right. It's all of our history, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, but you know what I'm saying? It's right. I don't have an ancestor who was, you know, who was there.
Right.
Except as a World War II veteran.
Right.
So I'm trying to sort of put all these pieces together with, is that healing then for the Jewish community as well? Like,
for sure.
Give me an example. Give me a specific example that I can wrap my arms around.
So I'm thinking of Art Spiegelman's Mouse,
right.
for example. And I would say, and I think other trauma theorists would say, that one of the intents of that piece of literature is for Spiegelman, who was not involved in the Holocaust, but his right. parents were, mm-hmm. right? That it's a way for him to sort of restore the order of his family and to heal in some way the trauma that his parents experienced in that piece of literature, he allows his father to speak and mm-hmm. tell his story, right? And that then becomes healing for Art Spiegelman himself, the author, and perhaps for the larger Jewish community. For the rest of us, I mean, I think most of us have experienced some sort of trauma. It might be smaller by comparison to some of these others, but for us to think about, you know, what are the wounds that we harbor and how do we articulate our experience coming out of those wounds in our own lives?
I think some people are asking that question. Well, you know, everybody has some sort of trauma, and many people are doing quite fine in the world. How do you sort of put that into perspective? Who wants to tackle that? The fact that, you know, there might be somebody who experienced an individual trauma, let's say, or someone, you know, a survivor of a cultural trauma. Some people go on and do quite well, others don't. How do we think about that? Jennifer.
Well, someone gave me an example once that I thought was helpful, that if you think of your ability to overcome trauma or overcome hardships in your life as you're born with a jar, and each pebble that's added to the jar is an additional anxiety or an additional trauma that you have experienced. And so when that jar overflows is when, you know, you start using meth or you start using alcohol or you do, you know, start hurting yourself in some way. And if some people are already born with that jar half full because of historical trauma that they've inherited, then they're already behind in this whole race of life, and it, you know, it gets filled up a lot faster. And some people maybe not are even born with historical trauma, but just have genes that are, you know, more likely to be triggered by anxiety or other kinds of triggers. So I think we're all born with this different levels of rocks in our jar, and we have to deal with that as things come.
Go ahead.
I was going to add to that. If you read Lakota Star Knowledge by Ron Goodman, he actually talks about that when the fetus is developing inside the womb of a female, that there's a time before birth, we don't know exactly when that is, that the actual soul or the Na'vi comes from that life up above in the stars and enters into that fetus and starts developing and becoming the soul of that infant to be born. And that sometimes we know that infants are born into a highly stressful environment. Maybe there's addiction or there's domestic abuse or things like that going on in the home. And in Lakota belief, sometimes that Na'vi or that soul will go back up into that life up in the stars and leave that child. So we actually have a ceremony of calling back the soul that sort of helps to rectify that spiritual ceremony that helps bring that soul back to the child. So people who would need this, they would contact a spiritual leader and discuss the issue and talk about what has happened. And then the spiritual leader will pray on it, and they'll decide that if a calling back the soul ceremony is warranted, and then they'll go ahead and do that. So I think it's amazing when you think about and hear about those stories, these sacred stories. They were so sacred, we were never even to talk of them. But this sacred story, to think that probably hundreds of years ago, the Lakota people were already thinking that there's something there with trauma. So it's just fascinating to me when you think about that.
And I feel like you have something to add to the notion of sacred stories.
Well, the sacred story for Christianity, which is my own religion, is born out of trauma to some degree. I mean, we've inherited the trauma of the Jewish people. My colleague Dick Swanson talks about the anguish of the grandmothers. And when you look at crucifixion and the community surrounding Jesus, I think we forget to call that a traumatic event. Instead, we tend to glorify the violence of the crucifixion, which I think is a dangerous way to talk about the sacred narrative there. It's extremely traumatic, even when Jesus appears in what we call the post-resurrection experiences. He still carries the wounds of the trauma. When he meets Thomas, for example, and I think doubting Thomas is a wrong attribution. It's maybe faithful Thomas who realizes that we carry the wounds of trauma with us. So I think for Christians, the early Christian community in particular really struggled with how to deal with this violent death of Jesus and the kind of violence that was part of the empire at that time. So trauma itself, I think, is built into sacred narratives and how people enter that. And sometimes I think people who have been traumatized, the religious beliefs can make it worse. For example, if a woman is abused by her spouse and she goes to her pastor and the pastor says, well, it says in the Bible that to be more like Jesus, you have to suffer, so you should stay in this abusive relationship. And I've had students tell me these stories, so I'm not making them up. Those kinds of spiritual reactions to trauma actually further traumatize. Right. So I'm interested in looking at how spiritual and religious practices and beliefs both help and hinder people when they face trauma.
You're listening to In the Moment. Stay with us. This segment continues after this break on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome back to In the Moment. Let's return to the conversation with Augustana professors Jennifer Goebbels, Carla Abbott, Ann Peterson, and Beth Boyens. In this segment, the group discusses the work the cohort is doing to reach out to Native American partners for collaboration.
There's a lot of brain power in this room, so let's talk about what you want to do. What are you hoping, now that we've sort of laid an extensive groundwork, what's the plan?
Jennifer. Well, that's a good question. So we would like to reach out to the Native American community and talk to them more about what is needed and how we can help. We would love to talk to some Native pregnant women and about their struggles and what we could do to help. We would love to support them both spiritually and with any information about pregnancy or childbirth, or maybe set up a mentoring program for pregnant women on the reservation with another woman, in their town that, has had children and they can work together. There's a great article that we read about a reservation in Arizona where they resurrected doulas and who help women, coach women through childbirth and midwives on that reservation there. And I mean, that's a huge pie in the sky kind of a goal, but that would be really cool.
I really think this is an opportunity for collaboration on a lot of fronts, whether it's Indian Health Service, tribal health programs, domestic abuse programs that are highly collaborative. I think there's an opportunity to do something. I think eventually as well, something to think about is once we get some sort of program going or interventions going with these young moms and preventing their preterm births, I think with Lakota culture, it's ingrained in us that we always are to give back. And I could see that maybe some success stories of whatever comes out of this, I could see some young mothers wanting to give back and being involved in the program themselves and maybe carrying that on and making it sustainable that way. I also think that this program wouldn't be successful if we didn't include the grandmothers, those that have all that wisdom. They've lived through so much, but yet are so very concerned about our youth right now. I think grandmothers are going to be important to this project as well.
In general, that's a good rule of life. Always include the grandmothers, right?
Right. Yeah.
How does, Beth, you know, how do you see the work that you're most comfortable with, you know, literature and writing and reading? How do you see that fitting into this whole project and these collaborations?
Yeah, I mean, I think reading literature, particularly Native American literature, I'm thinking of Louise Erdrich and others, you know, will help us sort of understand the narrative that comes out of those traumas and out of the wounds. You know, one of the things that I think this literature is trying to do is not to repeat the act of the trauma, not to sort of relive it and rehash it, but to narrate it in such a way that it becomes the voice instead of a reenactment of the trauma. Mm. And so I think looking at the literature in that way will hopefully help us understand maybe how to build that resilience and how to build that support for the community.
And Anne, your thoughts about bringing in those, you know, various spiritual practices, but, you know, specifically Lakota spiritual practices into preventing of preterm birth. What does that look like?
For me, it's going to involve learning. And I think because I'm not Lakota and I don't pretend to know at this point, it's going to really involve listening for a long time, I think, and learning. And I know my work with Carla has been a great example of how I see things in South Dakota differently now. I've read Star Knowledge about 5 or 6 times now, and I just see things differently in my own Christian faith from having listened carefully to some of the Lakota wisdom she's taught me. So my hope is that a step farther down the line with this for me will be that the Christian clergy that I work with and know can also adopt that practice of listening and learning from another spiritual tradition that in some cases was traumatized by Christians. Right. But I think in this initial project, it will be to look at sort of the embodied practices of these women that they tell us that they need help with. So whether it's beading or writing or whatever, I think Carla will be our guide to listen to these women and to learn about what those practices will be.
That's an interesting point when you look at there's a traumatizer. Mm-hmm. is that a word? Is the group or the person or the, you know, institution that inflicted the trauma.
Right.
Can they realistically be part of the healing process? Yes or no?
I would say it depends on the traumatizer. You know, there are definitely people in our society that still have that mindset of, look, you know, you guys need to just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and move on like the rest of us colonizers did. Mm-hmm. You know, some people are going to feel that way. But then there's going to be the other end of the spectrum of people who maybe didn't have a role in it. Maybe their ancestors had a role in it. But they're very sympathetic and very concerned about having a hand in some sort of reconciliation of that trauma or maybe using what expertise they have to help with that. I think that's all great. I also think, too, we're going to be shocked by just the strength that these young mothers have now already and what they're going through now with historical trauma, but also these new traumas like addiction, abuse, and violence that's happening now more and more frequently. So we may come out of this just learning amazing things about what makes someone survive all that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, I'm wondering, you know, we're not at the point where you measure outcomes, but as a scientist, you're used to measuring outcomes in a certain way. How are you going to approach the effectiveness of collaboration coming from your background?
Right. So normally, you know, we would have some kind of intervention and then, you know, look at these women 9 months later and see how many had preterm births, right? But I don't really look at this as a short-term project. This is a lifelong, you know, endeavor, and that maybe I would see a tiny movement, you know, a long time from now. Or, I mean, hopefully it doesn't take that long. But I think if we can just start talking to people, for me, that's important. Getting out this message about historical trauma and the adverse effects on health and the adverse effects on mothers and how, you know, and the preterm birth rates, and as far as, you know, grant writing and things like that, I'll have to learn about qualitative measures to analyze these things, and I will also be doing a lot of learning about how to analyze things differently.
Right. Carla, do you have initial thoughts on that as far as measuring, you know, the value of something as you go on? Like, you know, what's working, what's not? How do you look at that
exactly,
and make adjustments then?
I think what Jennifer's saying about qualitative measures is going to be really important. I'm sure that with our interactions with them, we're going to find out some themes that each person possesses, and then we're going to find some common themes. And then we'll go from there and kind of make inferences off of those common themes. But it'll also allow us to maybe put some interventions in place, build some collaboration with the entities that are there on the reservation, whether it's the domestic abuse programs, tribal health or Indian Health Service programs. Or maybe these young girls will come up with some new idea of what they really need and to survive and to make a healthier life for their babies.
Right. Let's talk about resilience. Is there more to sort of be explored there, Anne, from a spiritual standpoint? When you talked about, you know, embodied practices, what exactly does that mean, the embodiment of a practice?
Well, I think in our Western culture in particular, I was always taught that mind and body were sort of separate. Body and soul were separate, so what you did spiritually didn't really have much to do with your body, and we're finding out that that's not really accurate, either religiously or scientifically, and that the whole person, including the environment around you, is what makes up who you are, the environment and relationships around you. So when you look at, for example, religious practices like the Eucharist and the Christian tradition, it's a very embodied practice. Mm-hmm. And you can always tell in a congregation by if you change part of the practice, like you withdraw something from it, or you have people come up in the different direction of the church, everybody gets all upset because their routine was. And it sounds funny at one level, and yet you realize how deeply physically embodied these are. So resilience is for me connected religiously to the word hope. And I always used to think of hope when I was growing up Christian as someplace later, like it will be a heaven down the road or something. And for me, hope has taken a different perspective now when I talk about resilience. And some of the literature in resilience is also linked to people with stress from illness. So, like, I've read a lot of cancer narratives and dealt with my own little bout with it. And the word hope and resilience there are much about taking care of working with your body that will then heal your spirit. It doesn't usually work the other way around. In other words, I can't think my way into resilience. So when I had some experiences, and this is such a minor thing, I had very bad migraines a few years ago. My doctor sent me, she said, there are no pills for you. So she sent me off to do Pilates. And Pilates was developed, you know, in World War I by Joseph Pilates as a response to trauma for the men in the war. And what they found out is they could exercise their way into resilience. And so I think what we're learning is that the body itself needs to be retrained, and those practices will lead to resilience.
Wow. Beth, when we talk about literature and writing and telling stories, that we've mentioned the book Lakota Star Knowledge and some work by Louise Erdrich and others, it seems like there's a tremendous opportunity for more stories of what's happening right now in women's lives.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a potential for collaboration, the encouragement of people, whether it's writing or storytelling, of somehow expressing those stories and being empowered to do so?
Yeah, I mean, what immediately comes to mind is the Me Too movement, right, or the Time's Up movement, and just the power of words to, in a different way than Pilates does, to embody experience, right? I mean, words carry meaning. Words are heavy with meaning, and our willingness to listen to those words and interpret them, you know, I think is really important. And people speak in figurative language all the time, and if we just listen to that and think about what are the metaphors they're using to describe their experiences, that then becomes a way for us, I think, too, to support and intervene and hopefully change the course of the narrative.
What else needs to be said here today? And what happens next? What are the next steps?
Some of the next steps are our ongoing need to be up on the reservation to find in-house grant money. So we've been applying for some grants. Part of the interesting thing with the collaborative experience is that we don't know where we fit yet.
Right.
We applied to one religious organization, but I think we were too scientific. And so we're struggling at this point, learning to figure out where to get funding. And that's a new strategy for us. So I think learning how to work with each other and our strengths, and then figuring out the different niches where we can develop grant money. We are making connections with some folks at Sanford Research who have worked in this area before, and they are going to be coaching and helping us. So we're also looking to other mentors who have been doing work similar to this. And I think we're going to be in contact again with the Canadians. David and Joanne Olson are willing to work with us.
Interesting. Final thoughts?
I would just like to say that, you know, in all of this, we're not going to solve problems. We're not going to solve huge problems. Mm-hmm. But if we can research and get at what can help someone survive these problems, I think that's going to be really important. And it's really going to help us survive down the road. And I'm really excited about learning about resiliency. What part does spirituality play? Certainly, we think of Lakota spirituality, but there's also conventional spirituality as well. It has a presence on the reservation. Mm-hmm. Or is it a combination of several things? You know, so I'm really excited about what we're going to find out. And I'm even more excited to see where it might lead to Lakota people standing up and helping one another in this really a time of crisis.
Up next, Kevin Wooster joins us. Stay with us. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.